It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Have you ever asked yourself how you know what you know? Take climate change, or gay marriage, or gun control. You have opinions, but how exactly did you form them?
The findings in social psychology show that we are much more like lemmings than we are like mavericks able to do whatever they think right. We're not very good at reasoning to weigh up all the pros and cons and decide which policy will yield the best results overall.
Mostly, we take what we believe for granted, whether it's about politics, human nature, or God.
I think sometimes the way monotheists talk about God is unreligious. People will say, God loves that, God wills that, and God despises the other. And very often the opinions of the deity are made to coincide exactly with those of the speaker.
Today, how to challenge your own beliefs. Take a second to think about what you know about yourself. Maybe it's that you're the smart one in your family, or that you're one of those highly creative right brain types. Well, it turns out that even the most basic things we believe about ourselves are often wrong. And the reason has to do with how the brain works. Neuroscientist Julian Keenan studies self-awareness and deception. He's the author of The Face in the Mirror, How We Know Who We Are. You know, this age-old question, how do you know you're you? It's a hard question to ask. Who's the I asking the question?
Right. That's one of the first complicated questions here. In science, we call it the Cartesian theater, the idea that there's someone inside my head looking at someone inside my head who's looking at someone inside my head, and you keep going in that circle. And immediately from that problem, we jump to a new problem, which is once I figure out that I'm me, how do I know that you're you?
Self-awareness is painful. A lot of the time. I mean, you know, some people are obviously more self-conscious than others, but almost all of us have had the experience. You get up, you get dressed in the morning, you look at yourself in the mirror and you think, oh, I wish I were in better shape. Or you have to give a talk in front of a lot of people and you feel like you're just going to die of self-consciousness. Why is our self-awareness painful a lot of the time?
Yeah, this is a great question, and it's the one I love to talk about. I think it's because I'm an evolutionist that I'm so negative. The negative aspects of the self are clear. I don't think, as I'm speaking here today, my cat is ruminating about a slight she's had in the past and she's planning for the future. Certainly not to the extent that I'm able to do it. The resentments that build, we go back in the past and we play out what we should have said. We go into the future and we say, I'm going to say this. And when you don't say that, then you have another chance to go in the back in the past and hate yourself. So clearly having a self can be a curse. And what we look at is how the self helps create a deceptive world and how it winds up leading to a lot of self-deception.
Wait, what do you mean? So we're having a sense of self means sort of inescapably that we're lying to ourselves?
I think so. You know, I went into this pretty naive. I was thinking, you know, and I think most people think this way, that the self is a wonderful thing to have. It leads to art and music and just tremendous things like jazz and abstractionism and great literature. However, on the other side, as psychological studies began to come out, a number of interesting findings were being published. One was the strength of false memories and how many of our memories are, in fact, not real memories. And then another sort of line of research was coming out showing how often people deceive not only to others but to themselves. So we think that one of the key components of the self is molding reality not so that it's real but so that it's palatable.
Wow. So my sense of self is really kind of a story or even a lie that I tell myself in order to kind of ease my progress through life?
Yeah, and it gets worse. I don't know if you want to hear the "and it gets worse" part.
Yeah, go ahead.
But there's a whole line of research that then shows that one of the things the self may be doing is leading you to believe you have free will when you have no free will. For example, a series of elegant experiments from the 80s by someone named Labette began to demonstrate that when we reach for an object, so right now I'm reaching for a cup, the arm moves first, and then the frontal lobe gets involved, or the self gets involved after the decision is made. And what the self does is thinks that it made the decision, but the arm was moving before the self even knew that the arm was moving. So there's this idea that free will is an illusion and your sense of self helps to create that illusion that you have free will.
Wait, you mean the body the body moves first and then the brain catches up? But then why does the body move? Why did you reach for the cup?
Well, what we think is that there are these areas of the brain that get involved that are reptilian old parts of the brain. They've been around for a long time and, you know, they're very reflexive and, you know, they're just tied into some very basic motor systems. And they get engaged and then your arm moves and about 2 seconds later, then your frontal lobe gets involved and says, oh, yeah, I meant to move it.
What does that say about higher orders of decisions that we make? You know, I'm going to invest in this stock, or I'm going to take the job, or...
Or I'm going to marry this person.
Yeah.
I mean, we're looking at that right now. Right now, you know, we have this study planned. We're having people make a decision of two very benign objects, two different coffee cups, two different garbage cans, two different blades of grass. And what we think is that we can influence which direction they go in by biasing one of their hemispheres. And after they make this decision, they'll come up with a perfectly rational explanation for why they've decided it.
How do you bias somebody's hemispheres?
Well, we have this wonderful machine known as a transcranial magnetic stimulator. So creating the bias isn't the magic. We've known about that for a long time. It's once people have that bias in their brain, will they realize that they have it? And we're pretty sure that they won't, that they'll come up with any other explanation like, you know, I like that garbage can because it was grayer, you know, or some sort of irrational explanation. And if this extreme view is true, then we think that a lot of our higher order decisions may come from pretty old parts of the brain, and we only rationalize them later.
So there's this secondary aspect to self-awareness that you study. Can you explain theory of mind?
Sure. The idea is that I have these thoughts, therefore, when I look across the room and I see another human being, I think that they have the same thoughts that I have. So I can think about what you're thinking about. I can think about what you're thinking about my thinking. And you can think about what I'm thinking about what you're thinking about my thinking. Right? And we can go back and forth with this like cognitive gymnastics where we get into each other's minds. And if I can think about my thoughts and my wife's thoughts, it makes for a much richer social interaction than if I'm only thinking about my thoughts, which does happen on occasion. So the idea is that having self-awareness leads to the awareness of others, which then allows for complex social interactions, really leads for a much richer life, particularly a much fuller social life.
And do these two things, my self-awareness and my awareness of you, do these things reinforce each other, have anything to do with each other?
Absolutely. So, you know, the way I see myself in part comes through your eyes. So if I know everybody in the room is thinking that, you know, I just played the worst guitar solo in the world, then I start to think I'm a very bad guitar player. So clearly, how I think about what you're thinking about me will influence ultimately how I think about me.
Are you saying we use other people as mirrors?
Absolutely. But it's also one of the greatest training tools, right? I mean, that's how we work with our kids. You know, I try to build up my daughter's self-confidence by telling her that, you know, she's the best hockey player in the world, and hopefully she'll start to believe it, and then that will improve her performance.
I just keep thinking that what you're saying is that much of our experience of life and of the world and even of ourselves is a lie.
Yeah. And you can either be depressed about it or just go for the ride. A lot of this remains still to be confirmed and replicated, but a lot of the indications are that we are living in a deceptive world at best, perhaps a false world in its most extreme.
Well, I'm trying to figure out what the consequences are of everything you've laid out. We have no free will. We're basically lying ourselves through life. What do you do with those insights? Should you just sit back and enjoy the dream, or should we all be meditating very hard and trying to lose our sense of self?
I'm going to go with the former. I think a lot of self-deception goes a long way, that giving yourself positive affirmations in the mirror, whether you believe them or not, would probably be the route I would suggest taking. You know, surrounding yourself with people who, even though you know they're lying to you, as long as they're saying good things, that's probably a healthy a healthy way to go. The alternative scares me. You know, we used to think people with clinical depression didn't see the world realistically. You know, they saw it in an overly negative light. Well, it turns out they're seeing it quite realistically, and it's you and I who are seeing it in an overly rosy light. You know, we're the ones not in reality. So the suggestion is that reality is a somewhat scary place to be.
So the purpose of therapy is to learn to be better at lying.
Absolutely. You know, that clearly puts into question this idea of deception as morality. Thou shalt not lie. Well, then thou shalt be depressed.
Do you ever wonder who we'd be if we didn't have any self-awareness?
You know, I wonder that about the chimpanzees, because clearly there are signs that they have some self-awareness. You know, maybe the Buddhists are onto something, that when you go on top of a mountain for 20 years, you know, you lose that sense of self. Maybe there's some serenity there.
Julian Keenan is a neuroscientist and the author of The Face in the Mirror, How We Know Who We Are. So here's a familiar scene. Thanksgiving dinner. Turkey, stuffing, and all the relatives. Even the ones you don't see very often. Someone brings up politics, and it all gets very tense. Or loud, depending on the family. Crossing the political divide is challenging. Other people's beliefs can seem so illogical. But why are we always so sure that we're on the right side of reason? Jonathan Haidt is a social psychologist and the author of The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. And he says that despite what we think, our political attitudes aren't always as well-reasoned as we believe them to be.
I spent my young adulthood hating Republicans, watching as the Democrats seemed to just blow it in election after election. And as I got deeper and deeper into it, I realized that they are actually right about many things, just as liberals are right about many things. The Republicans have just done a much better job of making appeals to the gut, making appeals that resonate emotionally rather than cerebrally. And politics, like so much else in life, is not a matter of calculation. It's a lot more like religion.
So tonight, I simply offer a prayer that with the guidance of God, we may prove ourselves worthy of His blessings of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
As much as we might want to think that we steer by our own moral compass, the findings in social psychology show that we are much more like lemmings than we are like mavericks able to do whatever they think right. We're not very good at reasoning to weigh up all the pros and cons and decide which policy will yield the best results overall. Much of my research has been to map out what are the taste buds of the moral mind. We find that liberal cuisine tends to rest most heavily on care, harm, compassion, suffering, all those sorts of issues. And so there's a set of moral concerns, and then policies grow out of that. Conservatives have all of those moral taste buds. They're not quite as compassionate, not quite as bleeding heart, but they have some others that liberals don't use as much, especially group loyalty, respect for authority, and a sense of sanctity or purity.
That's how it is in America. We look to our communities, our faiths, our families for our joy, our support in good times and bad. It's both how we live our lives and why we live our lives. The strength and power and goodness of America has always been based on the strength and power and goodness of our communities, our families, and our faiths.
We try to confirm whatever it is that we start off believing, and we're always able to do that. So the only way that you can think well is if you can have other people on the other side to disconfirm your pet theories. Our good thinking requires talking openly and listening to people on the other side. All these good ideas that you never even were exposed to because you're locked in your own sort of gated moral community. The danger is that now, for the first time in our history, the parties are not coalitions. Parties used to always be coalitions of interest groups. Now, for the first time, we have a perfect psychological split. All the people with a liberal personality and liberal values that go with it are in one party. All the people with a more conservative personality or disposition are in the other party. And that means that for the first time, the people in the other party really are different. They think differently from each other. They value different things. They're really different cultures. And that's dangerous because it makes it extra easy to demonize them.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, the Republicans are the real threat.
Every major city which is a center of poverty is run by Democrats. Every major city.
The way to do this is to think about indirect methods. There are some efforts to try to bring people together over food. Food is one of these deep things. When you eat with people at the same table, it activates ancient circuits of trust. You're saying we are like family. So I suggest indirect methods focus on relationships first and then gradually introduce policy questions or other political questions. So rather than just coming at them saying, why do you believe X if you also believe Y? Rather than that, if you go and you say, conservatives are really concerned about personal responsibility. You know, tell me about that. Do you see both parties as fostering that? And if you make that sort of opening, which shows that you're not attacking, you're trying to understand, you often are met with a reciprocal gesture in which, say, you know, your brother-in-law might say, yeah, you know, the Democrats, they've always been against personal responsibility. But then he might soften him and say, you know, on the other hand, the Republicans, you know, so the way they bail out the banks, they haven't been so good on it either. So you got to get reciprocity and acknowledgement working for you. Don't just recreate the normal form of political engagement, which is a fight.
Jonathan Haidt is the author of The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. Coming up, why do some people buy into truly crazy beliefs? We'll talk with a journalist who tagged along with a group of Holocaust deniers to find out. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. In this hour, we're talking about how to challenge our own beliefs, which brings to mind an even more basic question. How do we form beliefs in the first place? How does a hunch gain the status of truth? Journalist Will Storr explores those questions in his book, The Unpersuadables: Adventures with the Enemies of Science. In it, he follows Holocaust deniers, climate change skeptics, and conspiracy theorists to find out how seemingly intelligent people can hold unconventional, even irrational, beliefs. We reached him at his home in London. One of the most dramatic chapters in the book is the story of how you went essentially undercover on a tour of World War II sites with a group of Holocaust deniers. What did you hope to learn from that experience?
Yeah, I think that was probably the most emotionally difficult thing I did for the book, because as you say, it was undercover. I actually went on this seven-day tour around Holocaust sites in Eastern Europe. And it's led by a guy called David Irving, who he's very famous in the UK. He's a British historian. So he leads these tours, and on these tours were just, a bunch of neo-Nazis, a bunch of people who were still Holocaust deniers and even more kind of lost in these ideas than he was. And it ended up being really fascinating, especially the followers, because a lot of these followers, it turned out, had German parents who served in the Second World War, and they were almost on this kind of tragic fight to kind of save the reputation of their parents against history.
But there are these just completely chilling moments during your time with them. One is when you're visiting a concentration camp and you're looking at a gas chamber, and I've forgotten who it was who insists, no, this is fake.
Yes, I mean, that was David Irving himself. I mean, and that really was very upsetting. We were actually in the gas chambers, and there was a tour of students going through the gas chambers, and he just started interrupting, shouting over the tour. He said those canisters didn't hold deadly gas, they're the wrong kind of canisters, and he pointed to these doors on the gas chamber. He said, these are standard air raid doors, and he pointed out that there were handles on the inside of the doors, and he said, you know, if this was a homicidal gas chamber, there wouldn't be handles on the inside of the doors. But on the outside of the doors, there were enormous great big bolts that would have clamped the whole thing shut over airtight seals. And so he saw what the rest of us saw, but it's almost as if he only saw the handle. That's all he saw. It was an extraordinary display of how selective our perception can be in only seeing the things that reinforce our personal truth.
Yeah, which winds up being the theme of your book, the way in which our beliefs, in fact, are not rooted in rational thought, but instead are often the product of unconscious emotions. I mean, where do those emotions, I guess, where do our beliefs come from in the first place?
We rely very much on our unconscious minds to decide what's true. You know, we believe what we feel is true, not what we're told is true. And the feelings come first, and you know, and the feelings are compromised, they're biased. And what we do is that we make a very instant judgment. And then we go out into the world looking for evidence just to reinforce that hunch. And that search in the world, it feels like we're being objective and sensible and weighing up evidence this way and that way. But we're not. All we're doing is looking for evidence that supports our view.
So are you saying we start with a belief, like let's say a homophobe thinks homosexuality is evil. You're saying we start with that belief, but we don't even know why we believe that. We just do. And then no matter what we're confronted with, we simply keep confirming our bias. Our brain kind of screens out all the reasons we might be wrong.
Yeah, this is true. But we become vulnerable to self-deceit when we feel extremely emotional about something. So one of the guys I interviewed is a brilliant author and psychologist called Professor Jonathan Haidt. And he told me that, you know, we were perfectly capable of coming to a rational decision about something, say, on climate change. If we go into that position not really caring either way, if climate change is real or false, you know, if we don't really care, then we've got every possibility of coming to a rational conclusion and weighing the evidence successfully and fairly.
Oh, so we should be most skeptical of ourselves when we care a lot about our beliefs?
That's the scary thing. I mean, he actually said to me, if you want to find irrationality, look for the things that we're most emotional about. Look for the things that we make sacred. And you see it every day on, you know, very fraught debates on Twitter, whether it be about gun control or feminism. You know, people get so emotional about it. And when, I don't know, for me now, when I see that level of emotionality, I just back away because I don't think you're going to get much out of that conversation.
And I want to be clear, you're not saying that we're sloppy thinkers or that we don't have the brains or the wit to question our assumptions. It's not about us being stupid about some things.
Definitely not. No, this is just the way the human brain works. We are surrounded by a superabundance of information. Some scientists believe it's millions of bits of information we can absorb at any moment, and we're aware of something like 40 or 50. So, you know, one of the ways, you know, say it has to pass that information in a certain way. Essentially, it lies to us by telling us partial truths, and because it's a way of simplifying the world.
The depressing thing is that it almost sounds like you're saying we're all prone to bias. We all have beliefs that we've developed irrationally, and we simply keep confirming them over and over again, and our neural circuitry perpetuates our bias. So how are we supposed to figure out whose opinions we can trust?
Well, that's it. It's completely disorientating and terrifying. I agree. But it's, you know, fascinating nonetheless. And I guess if there is a hero to my book, it is the scientific method. You know, we're creatures of story. We experience our lives as stories that are populated with heroes and villains. And, you know, we're obsessed with our own mission, our own heroic mission in the world. And is this the way that we kind of experience the world that makes us vulnerable to self-deceit? Because we tend to believe the things our allies tell us and disbelieve the things that people that we don't feel allied to tell us. But the method that has blown all this apart, all these distortions of bias, the thing that's blown that apart is the scientific method. I mean, it's designed to take all of that away. and leave only truth. I mean, obviously it's flawed, but it's the method we have that does away with all these kind of toxins.
So, Will, after all of this, did you uncover, do you have any kind of practical day-to-day advice for how to question your own beliefs?
I think the main thing is just to watch out when you're becoming emotional about something, when you feel that kind of heat rising in your chest, because those are the warning signs, those are the red flags. You know, when your brain is not going to go out there and defend you by saying, hang on a minute, listen to what the other person's saying. It's going to defend you, make yourself feel good by telling you you're right and they're wrong. And so I think that's the main thing.
Will Storr is the author of The Unpersuadables, Adventures with the Enemies of Science. And now, we turn to another kind of belief, one that's divided human beings for centuries, even led to countless wars, and that's religious faith. Karen Armstrong has written more than 20 books on spiritual subjects, including The Great Transformation, the beginning of our religious traditions. She says, ironically, many of the world's major religions, including Confucianism, Taoism, Buddhism, Hinduism, and Judaism, have a common origin. That is, they all started during the same historical era, the Axial Age, from 900 to 200 BC. She tells Steve Paulson that they emerged as a response to the violence of the time.
It was one of the great interesting discoveries to me. I couldn't believe it when I was researching this against the backdrop of our own time, when religion is often used to justify atrocious acts, that in every single case the catalyst for religious change had been a revulsion, a disciplined turning away from violence.
So what was the message, what was the spiritual message that rejected violence?
First of all, they all insisted in very different ways, but they came to the same conclusion, that you must give up and abandon your ego, that the cause of violence, hatred, and human evil is very largely rooted in desperation about the ego. We are egocentric creatures, and so the sages said that the root cause of suffering lay in our desperate concern with self, which often needs to destroy others in order to preserve itself. Mm. And so they insisted that if we stepped outside the ego, then we would encounter what we call Brahman or God, Nirvana or the Tao.
And you say this was one of the common messages in all these religions was what we now call the Golden Rule. And it was really Confucius who was probably the first person who came up with this idea.
All these sages, with the exception of the Greeks, posited a different sort of a counter-ideology to the violence of their time. And the safest way to get rid of egotism was by means of compassion, when you dethrone yourself from the center of your world and put another person there. And so the first person to promulgate the Golden Rule, which was the bedrock of this compassionate, empathic spirituality, was Confucius, 500 years before Christ. Mm. Do not do to others as you would not have done to you. His disciples asked him, what is the single thread that runs through all your teaching and pulls it all together? And Confucius said, look into your own heart, discover what it is that gives you pain, and then refuse under any circumstances whatsoever to inflict that pain on anybody else. The Buddha had his version of the Golden Rule. Jesus taught it. And Rabbi Hillel, the older contemporary of Jesus, said that the Golden Rule was the essence of Judaism.
Now, do you see parallels between what happened 2,500 years ago and what's happening in the world today?
Well, yes, we too are living in a very, very violent period when the world is changing radically, when we have no idea where we're going, where we seem to be on the brink of destroying one another. And the Axial Sages had that very, very strong feeling too as life took these dangerous turnings, steps forward.
Now, there is the question of whether all of these religions you've been talking about were actually religions. I mean, the ancient Greeks, certainly Socrates and Plato, where, their philosophies were not religious at all. Buddhism, in a way, is essentially a philosophy of mind. Confucianism, I suppose you could see it as essentially a system of ethics.
That's a very chauvinistic Western view, if I may say so. You know, you're saying this is what we regard as religion, and anything that doesn't measure up to that isn't. I think a Buddhist or a Confucian would be very offended to hear that he or she was not practicing a religion.
Well, explain that then. Well, what is religion then?
Religion is a search for transcendence. But transcendence isn't necessarily cited in an external god, which can be a very unspiritual, unreligious concept. The sages were all extremely concerned with transcendence, with going beyond the self and discovering a realm, a reality that could not be defined in words. Nirvana. Buddhists talk about nirvana in very much the same terms as monotheists describe God.
It's so hard today to wrap our heads around that Buddhism, which is essentially non-theistic, that notion of nirvana is essentially the same, or the message is the same. The experience of
the
Christian God.
And the trouble is that we define our God too closely. We say God is the supreme being. Well, in my book about God, written some years ago, A History of God, I pointed out that the most eminent Jewish, Christian and Muslim theologians all said that you couldn't think about God as a simple personality, an external being. It was better to say that God did not exist, because our notion of existence was far too limited to apply to God.
Didn't a lot of people say God was beyond language? I mean,
we
could only get the sort of experience, the glimmers of the afterglow of God.
And that's simply what the Buddha is saying. You can't define nirvana. You can't say what it is. You can just get intimations of it by the practice of compassion and by the systematic extirpation of egotism. He was once asked by a Brahmin priest who passed him in contemplation and was absolutely mesmerized by the picture of this man sitting with utter serenity, utter concentration, and he had a great sense of power reined in. And he said to him, "Are you a god, sir? Are you an angel or a spirit?" And the Buddha said, "No." He said, "I'm awake." That his disciplined lifestyle had, as it were, activated parts of his humanity that ordinarily lie dormant.
So you're saying that these ancient sages really didn't care about big metaphysical systems. They didn't care about theology.
No, none of them did. And indeed, neither did Jesus. Jesus did not spend a great deal of time discoursing about the Trinity or original sin or the incarnation or the atonement, which have preoccupied later Christians. He went around doing good, being compassionate, practicing the axial age spirituality of Jian Ai, as the Chinese called it, concern for everybody, even people who were left regarded with disdain by the establishment. And in the Quran, metaphysical speculation is regarded as self-indulgent guesswork, zanna. And it makes people, the Quran says, quarrelsome and stupidly sectarian. You can't prove these things one way or the other, so why quarrel about it? I think sometimes the way monotheists talk about God is unreligious.
Unreligious, like the personal God, for instance?
Yes, because people very often talk about him as though he's a kind of acquaintance whom they can second guess. People will say, God loves that, God wills that, and God despises the other. And very often the opinions of the deity are made to coincide exactly with those of the speaker.
And yet we certainly see talk of a personal God in various sacred texts. Aren't just making that up.
No, but the great theologians in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam say, yes, you begin with the idea of a God who is personal. But God transcends personality as God transcends every other human characteristic, such as gender. You know, very often people hear about God at about the same time as they're learning about Santa Claus. Mm-hmm. But their ideas of Santa Claus mature and change in time, but their idea of God remains infantile.
What about the supernatural, though? I mean, do you need any sense of the miraculous or of, things that cannot be explained by science, by this world?
I think religions hold us in an attitude of awe and wonder. People such as the Buddha thought miracles were rather vulgar. you know, displays of power that are often displays of ego. And I think we need to look carefully at the, if you look at the miracles attributed to Jesus, the healing miracles, they generally had some kind of symbolic aspect about healing the soul rather than showily showing off a supernatural power, you know, because that can be an exercise in egotism too.
Well, it does raise the question, though, of how to read the sacred scriptures.
Indeed.
And because there are all kinds of inflammatory things that are said there. I mean, there are, for instance, many passages in both the Bible and the Quran that exhort the faithful to kill the infidels. And Sam Harris, in his book The End of Faith, has, I think, seven very densely packed pages of nothing but quotations from the Quran with just this message, God's curse be upon the infidels, slay them wherever you find them, fighting is obligatory for you, much as you dislike it. And Sam Harris's point is that the Muslim suicide bombings are not the aberration of Islam, they are the message of Islam.
Well, that's simply not true. I mean, you know, he's taken parts of those texts and omitted their conclusions, which says fighting is hateful for you and you have to do it if you're attacked, as Muhammad was being attacked at the time when that verse was revealed. But forgiveness is better for you, it always ends. Peace is better. But to isolate these texts as though they were expressed the whole of the tradition is very mischievous and dangerous at this time when we are in danger of polarizing other people. This kind of inflammatory talk, say, about Islam, is convincing Muslims all over the world who are not extremists that the West is incurably Islamophobic and will never respect their traditions.
But yet, on the other hand, you talk to some of these people who would say, well, you know, it's not, you can't really just pick out the peaceful and loving passages of the sacred scriptures because there are plenty of other passages in there that
I would say there are more passages in the Bible than the Quran that are dedicated to violence. And I think what we all ought to do, religious people, in this day and age, is to look at our own sacred traditions, our own, not just pointing a finger at somebody else's, but our own. Christians should look hard and long at the Book of Revelation. And they should look at those passages in the Pentateuch that speak of the destruction of the enemy. It is not enough to point an accusing finger at another faith when our own tradition, and indeed our own secularists, let's not forget that in its short history, secularism has had some catastrophes.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly most of the tragedies of the 20th century were committed by secularists, Stalin, Hitler.
Hitler, Saddam Hussein, another question in point, a secularist supported by us in the West initially for 10 years. Even when he gassed the Kurds, we supported him because he was a secularist. And if people are resistant to secularism in Iraq now, it's because their most recent experience of it was Saddam. So I think this kind of chauvinism that says science is right, religion is wrong, or secularism is right, religion is all bomb, this is one-sided and I think basically egotistic.
Well, it seems to me that you're saying also that to be religious, to really be religious, is tremendously hard work.
Yes.
I mean, it's far harder than just
singing a few hymns.
Well, or just reading the scriptures and just trying to literally read these and take the messages and apply them to your life. I mean, you can't live that way.
Basically, religion is hard work. It's an art form. It's a way of finding meaning, like painting, like music, like poetry, in a world that is violent and cruel and often seems meaningless. Religion is like any other activity. It's like art or cooking or sex or science. You have good art, sex and science, and bad art, sex and science. It's not always easy to do it well.
Karen Armstrong has written more than 20 books about religion, including The Great Transformation, The Beginning of Our Religious Traditions. And that's it for Talking About Belief today. When we come back, we'll mark the 25th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square protests and a dangerous idea. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
I'm Harvey Kay, professor of democracy and justice studies at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. And my dangerous idea is American exceptionalism. It may sound surprising to you, right? American exceptionalism sounds like a very conservative idea. But you know what? For more than 200 years, American exceptionalism was a radical idea. It was the idea of liberals and progressives. It was an idea that didn't say we are superior, that we have all the answers. No, it was an idea about what America could be, should be, and if we act on it, would be. Think back to the words of someone like Thomas Paine. We have it in our power to begin the world over again, and his call for the creation of an unprecedented democratic republic. Think about the founders, the writing of the Constitution. We hear about its conservatism, but those first words, we the people, radical words. Those kinds of words, they provide for a kind of democratic imperative, a democratic impulse in American life. You know, there's a radical democratic spirit inside almost all Americans. This was an idea of American exceptionalism, proving that we the people can govern. And we don't need kings. We don't need aristocrats. We can govern ourselves. Moreover, not necessarily only in the political sense. We can govern ourselves economically. We can govern ourselves culturally. And then think about the generations of Americans empowered by that kind of argument. The free thinkers, the abolitionists, the women's rights advocates, labor unionists, civil rights campaigners. These folks believed in American exceptionalism, and they used that belief that they knew they shared with their fellow citizens to challenge their fellow citizens to make America freer, more equal, and more democratic. It wasn't natural, wasn't inevitable. But that democratic imperative, that, if you like, American exceptionalism idea, empowered generations to make America better, to recognize that we were a grand experiment in democracy, and the only way you can carry out an experiment is to test its limits. Now, something obviously went wrong. Now, if you hear the argument about American exceptionalism, it's a conservative argument. You know, it's about not life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. Protect property, limit government. It's not about democracy, it's about individualism. But even sadder than that, because we've always heard conservatives argue that kind of thing, you have to defend what exists, you don't advance what exists. The saddest thing is, liberals and progressives seem embarrassed by the idea of American exceptionalism because they've somehow allowed themselves to believe that that's strictly an argument of superiority, strictly an argument of we have all the answers, instead of understanding it as a challenge to enhance freedom, equality, and democracy. And the danger is that if we forget that dangerous idea, we will cease to be Americans.
That was historian and sociologist Harvey Kay with his dangerous idea. You can hear more dangerous ideas on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This week, we're thinking about China. It's been 25 years since the Chinese military cracked down on protesters in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. It was a serious blow to the country's pro-democracy movement. To catch us up on how dissidents have fared since then, we're revisiting an interview with historian Ian Baruma. He's the author of Bad Elements, Chinese Rebels from Los Angeles to Beijing. When he and Jim Fleming talked, they started by comparing Russia and China in the years after the Tiananmen protests.
Economically, China looks to be in better shape, but economics isn't everything. And I think that politically, it's much less stable than it looks, partly because so much is staked on the continuous economic growth and the promise that everybody's going to get richer. That is the main legitimacy for a one-party state in China. And it's not much of a legitimacy when things start to go wrong economically.
It seems to me that what you've written is that it is this difference in their approach, curiously enough, toward authoritarianism that sets them apart now.
Well, indeed. And that's why I think the Russians are politically in better shape, even though it's not a perfect democracy. Obviously, it's flawed. There are all kinds of problems. There's huge amounts of corruption and so on and so forth. But at least it's not a government that is in the eyes of most of its people is considered to be less than legitimate. So it can ride a crisis perhaps more easily than a government which has very little legitimacy left, particularly since Tiananmen.
How do you explain the different ways that these two countries approached the need for change? Is it simply a matter of the difference between Mikhail Gorbachev and Deng Xiaoping?
Well, to some extent, I think history is a series of accidents and unforeseen consequences and so on. Gorbachev, of course, tried to save the Communist Party by reforming it and introducing more democratic forms of government, and in so doing destroyed it. The Chinese watched this happening and are not going to make the same mistake. It could have happened in China, in theory. It didn't. And it's now too late to happen, as it were. I mean, the Chinese government is not going to go the Gorbachev route because they know that that's political suicide.
You've written that the model may be admired in both countries now, in both Russia and China, is not so much American democracy or even pure capitalism, but the kind of government that Augustus Pinochet pursued in Chile, even though he's gone now. It seems an odd model for a communist government to follow, doesn't it?
Well, the people who talk about Pinochet a lot in Moscow are not really communists anymore. What they like and what the Chinese or people in the Chinese government and in the Communist Party like is the combination of political authoritarianism and more or less capitalist economics. And that is where Pinochet is a model. And so not everybody in Moscow talks about that at all. It's mostly people who favor a more authoritarian type of government. In China, again, because communist dogma is no longer really sufficient to justify the monopoly on power, people in the Communist Party in China are looking for other ways to justify it. And one is to bring back some kind of Confucian idea of having a traditional kind of Chinese authoritarianism. Another is to go the Pinochet route.
So what do you see as the nature of the debate in China now?
Well, in public, of course, there is very little debate, even though because of the internet, there's a huge amount of noise going on and different opinions being expressed and so on. But there is no real debate in the sense of having Democrats on the one side and anti-Democrats on the other. I mean, the Democrats don't have a public voice.
Obviously, debate is going on, even though there is no public forum for it. I mean, what happens to an individual who disagrees with official policy?
Well, it depends on how he or she disagrees. You can say pretty much what you like in China in private. I've heard Chinese in restaurants in Beijing denounce the Communist Party. Nothing much will happen. Where the government has drawn a line is on anything that is organized, whether it's religious or political or cultural, that is beyond government control, or opinions which are published, in other words, where the private is made public. That's when they crack down. And so the public debate is still very much controlled. What people do in private is now much freer and looser.
You mentioned a moment ago the presence of the internet in China and how that has changed things. The government has been pretty active in trying to shut down debate on the internet, but that's difficult to do.
It is difficult, and they do it by essentially by intimidating people, by occasionally arresting people for internet-related offenses and crimes, hoping that it'll scare other people off, closing internet cafes and that kind of thing. Yes, it is difficult, but it's interesting because it's a problem that Chinese governments have really faced for more than 100 years, which is that they realize that in order to modernize their country and their economy, they need to bring in and to be open to Western ideas. On the other hand, they don't always like what comes in with those Western ideas. So they want the technology, they want a lot of what is available in the modern world, but they don't want anything that could subvert the monopoly on power of the government. And this was a problem in the 19th century, and then they called it Chinese essence, Western technique. And now they want the internet and all the benefits it can bring, but they don't want the stuff that comes in through cyberspace.
The main element of your book about Chinese rebels is the dissenters, the Chinese dissenters, both in China and abroad. Now, I have to confess that I was surprised to discover they were not all political dissidents. Tell me about some of these people that you've talked to. Zhou Litai.
Yes, you see, he's very interesting. He's a self-made lawyer. He comes from basically a peasant family in a village in Sichuan. He taught himself the law and became a practicing lawyer and takes these cases of people in southern China who've had industrial accidents and so on. And what he really wants is the rule of law. Now, he's not an overt dissident. He doesn't seek to overturn the government, or he's not an activist in that way. On the other hand, if what he really wants came to pass, it would be very undermining of the present system. Because just as the emperors used to be, the Communist Party is above the law. They make the law. and they bend the law to suit them. If you have rule of law, then even those who govern a country are accountable to it.
One of the other dissidents that you have talked to is Wei Jingsheng.
Mm-hmm.
He has spent a good part of his life in jail. What is his future?
Well, that depends a bit on what the future is of China. I mean, he's a figure that pops up in the history of all exile dissident groups over the last two or three centuries. And these are very brave people who have played a role in their own societies and paid a very heavy price for it. And then in exile sort of find themselves rather adrift.
Wei, in fact, is quite critical of other dissidents, isn't he?
Yes, I mean, one must remember that anybody who's prepared to spend years in jail and be tortured and so on without breaking for their beliefs, for their political beliefs, are going to be tough nuts. And these are not easy characters. They're not pliable people who make compromises easily and so on. It's his very inflexibility, really, that allowed him to withstand years of torture and interrogation and so on in solitary confinement in jail without cracking. And it's to be expected that such people have a hard time cooperating with others when they live in freedom.
Well, and you found others who were strong dissidents in China, exiled, who essentially found themselves happy to be where they could live out their lives, make a lot of money, and not be worried anymore about China. Is that right?
Well, I think they may be worried about China, but I think it's legitimate in a way what they do. I mean, what they wanted, this is mostly the younger ones who've been successful, the ones, particularly the former student leaders in Tiananmen, who came to America when they were still in their 20s often. And what they wanted in China is really what they got in America, which was the freedom to lead the lives they wanted. Tiananmen ended in failure. Many of them were disillusioned. They were here, and the best thing they could do was to be successful in America as immigrants, and many of them are Americans now. And the intelligent and ambitious ones are doing very well.
Ian Baruma is the author of Bad Elements, Chinese Rebels from Los Angeles to Beijing. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tungekart produced today's show, with help from Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Stephanie Youngblood. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.